From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Mateo.
San Francisco, Mission Dolores Park.
Financial District near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
Coming up, we'll ask what options do low-income immigrants have when they need an attorney?
And when somebody calls us and we say, no, we can't help you, we know that they've already talked to five agencies and they've heard that same answer from those five agencies.
Then Vietnamese immigrant tales come alive in a new book of short stories.
I feel that if I'm going to tell the story of Vietnamese in San Francisco, I need to talk about sex and talk a lot about sex.
Fiction from the lives of new Americans. And we'll show you where to look for a celestial treat tonight, but
the bad news is comets are really beautiful to look at, but very dangerous.
The problem with comets today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. When criminal defendants can't afford to pay for a lawyer, the court will appoint them one for free. But not all defendants have that right. If you're called to immigration court, for example, you have to hire a private attorney, like these guys.
Corre riesgo de ser deportado. Problemas con inmigración. Usted tiene derechos.
That's if you can afford an immigration lawyer. And if you can't, you're pretty much on your own.
El Immigration Law Group es el grupo legal para usted.
Immigration court is not part of the judicial system. It actually falls under the executive branch. In this story from our archives, reporter Jude Joffe Block looks into the options for immigrants who are facing a court date but can't afford an attorney.
You would never notice it if you were walking by because there are no signs. But San Francisco's Immigration Court is on the 8th and 9th floors of a nondescript office building here on Montgomery Street in the city's financial district. Immigrants can get a notice to appear here if they're facing deportation. The first court hearing begins in half an hour. I speak with a few people waiting outside. They're here without lawyers.
Do you guys have a lawyer today?
¿Cómo dice?
¿Tiene abogado?
Oh, no.
I should bring a lawyer, but I don't have one. I don't know if they're going to let me talk to the judge or not.
This man, who didn't give his name, will be able to speak with a judge. In fact, anyone here today for the first time will be represented by a volunteer attorney from the Bar Association of San Francisco. But after the first hearing, they'll need to find an attorney on their own if they want to be represented. Most won't. Even though research shows immigrants who have lawyers are much more likely to prove they have a right to be here. For many, it's just not possible. Most private attorneys charge between $3,000 and $10,000 for a deportation defense case. While the court doesn't offer attorneys, it is required to distribute a list of free legal service providers so low-income immigrants can find lawyers.
The list is updated quarterly. And it's posted on our website, and it's also individually distributed to non-citizens who are in proceedings before our courts.
Robin Stutman works for the body that oversees immigration court.
So certainly I would think that would be a very valuable resource for people who don't have the means to pay for attorneys to represent them.
Sure enough, a clerk on the 8th floor slides a couple sheets of paper across the counter as soon as I ask. I do my own dialing to see whether the 9 organizations listed are taking new clients. The first one is San Francisco's Asian Law Caucus, where I reach attorney Joran Lyons. He says on average, 3 or 4 people a day call seeking help after seeing his organization's name on the list. But he says the Asian Law Caucus is already handling close to 100 deportation defense cases.
That's about our limit. We're pretty much at the point that we can't take a new case until we finish an old case, unless there's something particularly urgent or compelling.
And Lyon says all nonprofit legal groups are facing the same problem.
There is no way that even every service provider that has any competency in immigration law, taking every single case they could possibly stretch themselves to take, there's no way even that would meet the demand for representation by people who cannot afford a private attorney. It's just beyond all conceivable capacity.
So instead, many organizations have decided to focus on offering advice. One of them is the nonprofit International Institute of the Bay Area. At its Oakland office, attorney Susan Bowyer is seeing clients in a cramped room stuffed with files and papers.
We can answer just a few of your questions. We aren't representing you yet. So. Okay. So what's your question?
Okay, my question is...
Bowyer's organization pulled itself off the court's list of free service providers. She says it was too heartbreaking to keep turning away people who were searching for free attorneys.
And when somebody calls us and we say, no, we can't help you, we know that they've already talked to five agencies and they've heard that same answer from those five agencies. And then they're going to call another five and get the same answer.
Bowyer says she wishes she could offer free representation in court to more people facing deportation, but she doesn't have the resources. Working on just one deportation defense case costs the organization $1,000. Asylum claims are even more expensive. But Bowyer says it's nearly impossible to find foundation funding or grants to support that work.
There isn't that kind of funding. There's not general humanitarian legal service funding available.
Bowyer helps immigrants determine whether to hire a private attorney.
People often can borrow money, and it's just a question of whether it's worth it to borrow that money. Do you want to be in debt for the next 5 years, or... You know, if you get in debt for 5 years, is it really going to save you from deportation, or is it?
When immigrants hire private lawyers, they also run the risk of exploitation. Some practitioners have taken advantage of unsuspecting immigrants by charging high fees on cases they can't win. So for some low-income defendants in immigration court, accessing an affordable and trustworthy attorney may be nearly impossible. For Cross Currents, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
Joran Lyons is now an immigration judge in San Francisco. Susan Bowyer is now the deputy director of the Immigration Center for Women and Children. And Anup Prasad, an attorney with the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco, says his office receives more calls daily now for immigration assistance than they did in 2010 when this story first aired. So what's been your experience with immigration law firms, and what do you think immigrants should do when they need legal help? Leave a message on our feedback line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we may get your call on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The immigrant experience is meant to be a smooth one, full of promise. Ideally, people from developing countries come to America for better work, education, human rights, and overall a better future for their children. However, many immigrant stories turn out to be not as polished as that narrative. Immigrants often need to learn a new language, navigate a new system, face realities they never have before, find their way in a new adopted country. Their hopes are high, and sometimes they end up unmet. A new book documents those realities. Vietnamese-American author Andrew Lam wrote a book of short stories chronicling the good, the bad, the ugly, the kinky and the hilarious of the Vietnamese-American experience here in the Bay Area. It's called Birds of Paradise Lost. Andrew Lam came to KALW Studios, and I asked him to talk about his life and how he got started in writing.
I was born in Vietnam and came to the United States at the end of the Vietnam War in 1975, in May. And
how old were you?
I was 11. And, you know, I was lucky because I left not as a boat person, but the last two days before the Saigon fell. And so we flew out and went from sixth grade in Vietnam to seventh grade in the United States, in Colma, actually, not very far from here. And then went on with my American life. And for a period of years, I felt that I didn't want to be Vietnamese. I didn't want to connect to the trauma of my past. I wanted to be completely American. Didn't want to speak Vietnamese at all. And it took some years before I came back to my roots, to speaking the language again, to come to term.
Do you remember what that process was like? What made you come back? What made you want to come back?
Well, when I went to Berkeley, I fell deeply in love with someone who was Vietnamese. And then I lost this person at the end of my years at Berkeley. And when I started writing, I was a pre-med. I was a biochemist. Lamba was a good boy, you know, wanting to be a doctor so mama be proud. I took UC Extension courses while doing cancer research in the lab. And the words poured out of me. And I started talking about this lost love, you know, the major love of my life. Of course, I only had one love at that point in my life. But I wanted to address it. I wanted to talk about what it felt like to lose this person. And I came to a passage in which I say something along the line that to lose someone with whom you share a private culture, a set of languages, a set of routine, a certain intimacy. And when you lose this person, you become an exile because you become lost and you've lost a country. And when I came to that passage, I realized this was not the first time I had a broken heart. This is the second time. The first time was when that 11-year-old stood on the island of Guam in the refugee camp, and the adults were listening to the BBC announcing the loss of Saigon and South Vietnam, the collapse of a whole country, and wondering what happened to his friends, his relatives, his dogs, his neighbors, his father, who, you know, hadn't come yet. And he has been traumatized, but he hadn't been able to talk about these things. And it was interesting that a personal heartbreak opened up the floodgate to the historical memory. And I kept writing and writing and writing. And one day I showed up in my extension class course at Berkeley. And the teacher said, "Andrew, you are not going to medical school. You are going to creative writing school. I send your stories to the MA program at SF State. And they say, just fill out the application and you're in." And I said, "Oh, my mother is going to kill me." And I actually filled out the form anyway.
Okay, so I asked you to pick a little piece to read. And here's the book.
Oh, dear.
Whichever little graph, paragraph you like. And then we're going to talk about it.
Sure. How about...
Except the parts about the dildos and all.
How about from...
Let's not do those.
Yes, I know. How about from show and tell?
Oh, yeah.
Which is a
fun what a
piece.
Mean little boy. Oh, I hate Billy.
So just a couple graphs.
Sure.
Yeah. Mr. K brought in the new kid near the end of the semester during what he called oral presentations and everybody else called seventh grade show and tell. "This is Cao Long Din," he said, "and he's from Vietnam." And immediately mean old Billy said, "Cool. What's so cool about that?" Kevin, who sat behind him, asked. And Billy say, "Idiot, don't you know anything? That's where my dad came back from with this big old scar on his chest and a bunch of grossed-out stories. And that's where they have helicopters and guns and VCs and all this crazy Billy would have gone on, but Mr. K said, "Be quiet, Billy."
Oh, wow. That's from the second story in the book. And do you draw from your own childhood? I know you kind of from 11 years old until the UC Berkeley extension, you were kind of blocking yourself out from the Vietnamese experience.
Yeah.
But
you know, it's really interesting. Just last week, I had a reunion with my junior high friends from, you know, a classroom that is very similar to the one I portrayed in Show and Tell. And my friends, I'm sure they will recognize the setting that I created in this book, in this story, because Mr. K is actually a real character. He was my teacher, and he's the one that oversees this sort of chaos called a bunch of naughty children.
He sounds like a passive teacher.
Yeah, but he steps in at the right times. And so, yes, I mean, I draw from that memory, you know, because the first 2 years in America was very impressionable. You know, Colma High School was not the easiest place to be, but it was also very diverse and fun, you know. And there were very kind friends that took me in, and we formed what my friend Michael Calder called the library gang, you know, a gang that hang out in the library and read the nerd kids.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I mean, so a lot of that comes from a buoyant memory of America, you know, when I first came.
Okay, so do you feel there were stories you didn't want to tell, or did you struggle with some?
Yeah.
For example, the first one in the book,
yeah.
which is...
It's called Love Leather.
Love Leather.
Yeah.
Kind of racy.
Kind of.
So, did you struggle with some of the material?
I feel that if I'm going to tell the story of Vietnamese in San Francisco, I need to talk about sex and talk a lot about sex because Vietnamese are very conservative people, traditionally anyway. But and so here they are descending into the city that sort of like the center for, you know, hippies and dropout and orgies in the 60s, you know, love inns. And so you can see the traditional conflict between the newcomers who carry this conservatism and the Folsom Street Fair. So I thought it's a perfect situation to do where you put a conservative family right in the middle of like whipping and, you know, leather daddies. And I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. And if people are willing to read the first short story, they're fine with the rest.
That's Andrew Lam, author of Birds of Paradise Lost, a short story book based on the lives of Vietnamese Americans in the Bay Area. Lam will be reading from his book on March 21st at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco. Details are at kalw.org. That's also where you can comment on the story and tell us about your story of immigration. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Before immigrants become American citizens, for a long time, they're officially known as resident aliens, a name many immigrants despise. It makes them sound like, well, space aliens who arrived in the U.S. by UFO. Well, UFOs may be a bit far-fetched, but this week there is something else coming from outer space. The comet Pan-STARRS can be seen in our western skies this week. To learn more about the science behind the spectacle, we talk to our local expert.
Hi, this is Paul Salazar. I'm the urban astronomer.
Salazar is a member of the San Francisco Amateur Astronomers and keeps a regular astronomy blog. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney about comet Pan-STARRS.
You're going to have a very, very clear horizon to see it. And it's going to be helpful if you have binoculars, too, because it's not very far from the sun. It's on its close approach, having just gone around the sun. And so that means that it has a good-sized tail, which is helpful. That makes a comet more beautiful to look at. But also, it's close to the sun, which means it only is visible for a short while after the sunset. You have to kind of really be on the lookout to find it in the right spot.
So it's not going to be a giant fireball over the ocean that lights up the sky and kills the dinosaurs.
This one is not that, no.
So with binoculars then, I mean, how can one figure out where to train those binoculars to be able to see it? And then will they be able to see kind of a dot with the tail?
Basically, for this next few days, this is due west. It's going to be a straight shot. Just look for the sunset point. Wait about 30 to 45 minutes as dusk begins to set in and the glare of the sun fades, and it should emerge from the glare.
And speaking of giant balls of fire that killed all the dinosaurs, we had something sort of close to that in Russia recently. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how that compares with, say, other comets or things that come from the sky that we weren't necessarily expecting?
The one over Russia was a good size asteroid shooting into Earth that, you know, some asteroids and shooting stars, as we loosely call them, when they come into Earth's atmosphere, they heat up and they make a big, beautiful, bright light and sometimes will hit the ground. This particular one over Russia was a loose amalgamation of stones, if you will, that basically once heated up about 20 miles above Earth's surface exploded into smaller fragments, which is what they've been finding all over parts of Russia. But also created that huge shockwave that broke all those windows and caused, you know, very serious damage. Luckily, no one was killed. That's a very unusual thing. And it provided us a chance to see the real power of what happens when a rock flies in from outer space and hits the atmosphere. Anything, you know, bigger than, let's say, a Volkswagen bus, right? I mean, that's about the reference point. When something gets bigger than that, it can cause some damage.
The thing about most Volkswagen buses is that they don't go very fast.
Good point there, yeah. So when something's out in space in orbit around the sun, just take the Earth all by itself right now as we're moving. We're traveling at about 65,000 miles per hour. So anything that happens to be in our way, we're going to impact at that kind of a speed, right? What's happening with all these asteroids is they too are in orbit around the sun, just like we are. And sometimes they catch up to us. Sometimes we catch up to them. Sometimes their orbits are inclined and they come down or up and impact us. In the case of Russia last month, that was, they estimate about a 20 or 30,000 miles per hour impact. The good news is that the truly deadly ones, the ones that would cause massive global or environmental damage or, you know, catastrophic apocalyptic type hits, those we generally know about well in advance. And we're tracking at this point, we meaning NASA and other science organizations, about 1,400 potentially hazardous asteroids, PHAs.
That
1,400.
That sounds like a euphemism, a potentially hazardous ball of fire coming at 20, 65,000 miles per hour from space that's possibly larger than a Volkswagen.
Well, yes. And their distances are measured in lunar distances. How many LDs away are they, right?
Like the distance from the moon.
And the vast majority are well beyond the orbit of the moon. So they swing by, we can see them. And because they're good sized, we see them. And so the tricky thing is there's that fine line where below a certain size threshold, we can't spot them well, at least not yet. Maybe the next generation of telescopes will. And as a consequence, the one that came in over Russia, we didn't know about. We just didn't see it coming. Literally, we could not have seen it. It was too small. Comets are a different category altogether. Comets come from much farther out in the solar system, way beyond the orbits of Pluto and Neptune and so forth. And when they come swinging in, the bad thing about comets is they come at a much higher speed. And the impact, the power of an impact, is the square of the speed. You double the speed, you quadruple the power. You quadruple the speed, you get a 16-fold increase in power. So the bad news is comets are really beautiful to look at, but very dangerous.
That's Paul Salazar. He runs the blog The Urban Astronomer out of San Francisco. So if there are about 1,400 potentially hazardous PHAs in space, and there are different comets going around, how often do these actually have some sort of a significant impact on Earth?
Relatively often in the grand scheme of things, like the one that was over Russia or the one, the meteor crater, those are sort of one in 100-year events.
That seems pretty frequent.
That's pretty frequent. That's correct. Now, granted, we have a lot of ocean. You know, something hits the ocean, it could cause a tsunami. But, you know, we are getting, let's take a step back. We're getting peppered by literally hundreds of tons of space junk every night. Literally. I mean, we're getting hit all the time by tiny particles, by medium-sized bits. And those kind of things are entering the atmosphere all the time. So basically, we think of space as empty. But when you're in the proximity of a sun, of a star, of a solar system, there's space stuff, just remnants of the birth of the solar system floating around. So we're bumping into smaller things all the time. As science has progressed, as imaging has progressed, we're able to track more. Like right now, we're tracking about 4,000 comets in various orbits, and we know where those are. And again, the biggest ones reveal themselves well.
Well, Paul, what's the plan if we find out a comet is, targeting Earth?
We have to steer it away. That's the real plan that NASA has in mind right now. And there are several different approaches in mind. Ultimately, you put something up close to it. There's what's called a gravity tug, where you fly a spacecraft literally next to it for a period of months, and you gradually nudge it over toward this tug, if you will. And all you have to do is move in orbit by a very small amount, if it's millions of miles away, and it eventually can be a miss.
So it's actually possible to re-steer one of these potentially hazardous comets or asteroids.
That's correct. You could use that. You could use ion propulsion. Literally, there's even discussion of painting, like you paint a side of it and you heat up one side over the other, and that'll push from solar wind away from a given trajectory. There's a number of good ideas out there.
Would that take Bruce Willis or Ben Affleck like landing on the comet and painting it?
Let's hope not. Those approaches were not too productive. Yeah, you don't want to blow them up. The bottom line is blowing them up is you just create lots of smaller asteroids or lots of smaller comets, and that's a bad outcome.
That's the urban astronomer Paul Salazar speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find a link to his blog at kalw.org, and you can probably get the best view of Comet Pan-STARRS at an unobstructed viewpoint along the coast. If you do, then tell us about it. Share your sighting experience on our Facebook page, KALW. And that's all for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Alyssa Kapnick, Christina Loring, Erica Moo, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, and Eva Sansin. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. They're online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll have a one-on-one with the top man in California's prison system.
Once you take a person out of the community and you put them in prison, you make it much, much more difficult for them to get back out again.
A chat with Jeffrey Beard. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. Pay attention, night owls. The song you're hearing now is by a Bay Area band called Owl Paws. What does that mean? You can ask the band yourself when they play at San Francisco's Bottom of the Hill this Thursday night, along with two other bands. Music starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Keep me around.